May it please the court, as the second member of this Miller legal relay team, I think it's my duty not to lose any ground and save it for the last leg, but I want to try to devote most of my time, or a substantial majority of my time, to the issue of retroactivity, which is unique to this particular case because the other two are on direct appeal. The other, I think, big issue in light of Miller is the appropriate remedy pursuant to implement Miller and also not contravene Missouri statutory or constitutional law. And as Judge Wilson noted, this is an unconstitutional as applied situation. It's similar to the mandatory death penalty cases that were struck down in the mid-70s by the U.S. Supreme Court, including Missouri's mandatory death penalty statute. In a lot of those cases, and in fact none of those cases, in any state, was the death penalty ever an option on resentencing. In most of them, what happened was that there was the more general capital murder statute that allowed for life imprisonment. And in Missouri, in the Duren case, what happened was is there was actually a savings statute that said if the death penalty is declared unconstitutional, which the legislature was obviously worried about that because their last statute was declared unconstitutional in Furman, that the defendant be sentenced to life without parole. And if you look at the Duren case, they cite the Harper case, which is the case that says if you don't have a valid penalty, the conviction must be overturned. And the only reason they didn't buy that argument, which the trial court did and dismissed the capital murder indictment, was because of this savings clause. There is no savings clause for life without parole. So the remedy in a lot of the mandatory death penalty cases was to sentence the person to life on the next most serious lesser included offense, which was constitutional back then. But now, in light of the Lockett-Eddings rationale of Miller, that would deny my client and the other similarly situated clients the opportunity for individualized sentencing. So the cleanest way and the best way to resolve this for the 84 men and women who have life without parole imposed when they were less than 18 years old is to strike down the conviction as unconstitutional as applied, remand the case for resentencing on the lesser included offense of second degree murder. And in a particularly aggravated case, undoubtedly the jury or the judge will resentence the person to life with parole. And there's a good chance that several of these people will probably never be paroled.
Well, why can't we just strike, to explain again why we can't just do what Arkansas did and sever the part of their first degree murder statute that said without parole, or that actually it left it, it's a Class A felony, which is the same punishment range as you're talking about under second degree, but it's a first degree.
Well, you could do that. I'm not sure that would take life without parole off the table. My whole point on this, and I find it odd that I'm arguing it for the interests of finality and ending this in an expeditious way, because usually I'm accused of the opposite. But what would happen if you, in any resentencing for second degree murder, no matter what it is, the case will be over with. If a person gets resentenced to life without parole, there's going to be appeals about proportionality. And I think the court's going to have to craft, to comply with Miller, some sort of proportionality review similar to what it does in death penalty cases.
Why would they need, if it was either life with parole or 10 years to life with parole, why would there have to be a proportionality review?
Well, it's not clear to me that that's what...
You're saying if we said life with or without?
My understanding of the Jackson case last week, and I haven't had time to study the Arkansas statutes, but I think the way they did that, the life imprisonment is life without parole, and they sidestepped the argument, which is also in Miss Eastburn's case, about that not should be categorically excluded because he was an accomplice like Ms. Eastburn. But the my whole point is that in aggravated cases where there's a life sentence imposed, the parole board will probably never let him out.
Mr. Gibson, isn't the weakness in your argument not one that you created, but that the Supreme Court itself created when they left life without parole as a possibility if you did it differently? And that's different than the death cases. They didn't leave death for particularly egregious cases or aggravating factors. They categorically barred it. Here, they didn't categorically bar life without parole. They just said you can't do it unless these factors are considered.
Right, but
that's the tricky part. I mean,
well, that's why I think this is exactly the same situation as the mandatory death penalty statutes that were enacted in response to Furman. Louisiana had a mandatory death penalty for rape, so did Alabama. There's a case called State versus Craig in the aftermath of Coker versus Georgia, where they said the sentence would be the maximum for regular rape, not capital rape. And it's the same sort of situation. In Duren, if there hadn't been a savings clause, if you read that opinion, I think it's pretty clear they would have ordered resentencing on the next degree of homicide, although Missouri's murder laws were rewritten in 1984, which changed it all around, but I think that's what would have happened. There's a case from Alabama, which I cited, the federal equivalent, that held the Sumner case mandatory death penalty of prison guards unconstitutional. In that case, they were able to salvage, they rejected the argument that he could be resentenced to death again because that statute is mandatory. However, there was a more general capital murder statute that allowed for life imprisonment, and he had to be resentenced to life imprisonment. The guided discretion statutes that came in after Gregg versus Georgia is a different animal, because in those sort of situations, you can change the resentencing procedures to give the jury discretion, and a lot of the arguments that aren't, such as in Daubert versus Florida, where it's procedural or substantive, don't come into play in the mandatory death penalty or mandatory life without parole situation. So I think that gives you clear guidance as to what to do. In my brief remaining time, I want to briefly touch on retroactivity because
Counsel, before you get to that, the trial court didn't ever discuss your client's Miller claim. Never reached it, isn't that right?
Pardon me?
The trial court never reached your client's Miller claim, isn't that right?
Other than mentioning it in passing, that's correct.
Because it denied the motion to reopen.
Right. No, so, well, it denied relief. The motion to reopen was all previously granted, and that was not disturbed.
But that raises the issue of abandonment and what was agreed to. And I know it was your position the state had agreed to reopen, that there was abandonment and to reopen the merits, and the state below said that that was not the case. They simply agreed that to present the issues and determine whether there was abandonment. And it seems like the motion court took the state's position and found that there was not abandonment, and therefore it was inappropriate to reopen. So do we reach any of these other issues?
Yes. So the court never said anything about abandonment. He said that it was a successive petition. He never addressed any of their
arguments. If it was abandonment, it can't be a successive petition. So he has to have rejected abandonment, because if it were abandonment, that's not treated as successive.
I don't think he said that. He didn't.
But the law says that. So. Tell me why we reach the merits of your argument on retroactivity and Miller here, as opposed to your needing to raise it in a habeas, as opposed to here.
Well,
if we found it wasn't.
The obvious answer is that they agreed to reopen the case, and then 6 months later changed their mind. And in many cases, some of which I've handled, in the Hutton case, which dealt with whether a conflict of interest could be abandonment that I was peripherally involved in, the state conceded abandonment after remand, and I think that's the sort of thing that litigants do in those sorts of cases to try to streamline things.
But your opponent denies conceding to abandonment, and there's nothing in writing, and isn't the trial court in the best position to make that determination of what the agreement was or was not?
The court signed the order saying by agreement of the parties that the case is reopened, the only valid reason for reopening. And the Judge Perrigo never, unfortunately, never readdressed that. And the other really unfortunate thing about this was that at the time, I didn't realize that even though we had appeared in front of the judge on the bench, the court reporter didn't transcribe any of this stuff. And I didn't know this until October of 2012.
Well, let me put this a different way. Doesn't the court have to find abandonment or a concession of abandonment at least in order to reach the substantive issues that you're raising? Why not?
Because the state agrees to that all the time just to save time.
We have to find either abandonment or that the state agreed to that there was abandonment in order to reach the substantive issues?
No. All this has to be agreed to is that they agree to reopen the case. And that's what happened here.
Let me ask you a question about that, Mr. Gibson. It looks like that is abandonment an exception to the time requirement for filing of a post-conviction motion? In other words, in this case, there was a timely post-conviction motion, and then there was an amended motion that was filed. And then I understand your allegations are that the amended motion was so patently defective that it really didn't work, and that's why they were abandoned. That's a summary of your case. But what's the best way to compartmentalize abandonment so that it makes some sense? Is it an exception to the time rule? Is it an exception to excessive motion rule? How does it fit?
Well, I think as the court said in Crenshaw, that's a developing area of the law, and it's not clear what the parameters of it are. And I think in a lot of these cases, it's real clear cut that there's abandonment, and the state will concede it. Like if you miss the deadline, the most classes, if you miss the deadline for filing an amended motion. But I think there's also situations where a local prosecutor can decide for whatever reason that the case ought to be reopened because maybe the defendant didn't have a fair shake or something like that. And I've had that happen in more than this case. But the bottom line is that there's no decision from this court saying that once there's a timely Form 40 filed, which takes it outside the Doris decision, that the state cannot affirmatively waive any procedural bar defense, which they did in this case. It isn't a case like the Rauer case that I think you handled back in the late 80s where they just didn't object or assent by silence. They appeared in court and agreed to reopen the case, and that's in the court's order. Just briefly, just so I won't breach my word, I am going to talk about retroactivity just for a second.
You have some more time. Your time is up for this time, but you have time in rebuttal.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. You may proceed.
May it please the court.
Proceed.
The issue of abandonment in this case is, or the issue of whether the trial court should have reopened this case, this post-conviction case, is really the only issue before the court. The question of retroactivity of Miller versus Alabama, the question of remedy to be applied in cases where Miller versus Alabama should apply, is not properly before the court.
Well, they are before us if we decide there was abandonment or it was reopened, but
yes,
not if we agree with you on that.
Yes, Your Honor. Of course, if the court were to find that the court should have reopened, then that might be an issue, although I would think that in that case it might be more appropriate for the motion court to consider those issues in the first instance as they were alleged below. But that being said, the motion court here in this case, its judgment was very limited. Its judgment did not address Miller versus Alabama, did not address the retroactivity or any remedy that should be imposed.
When you reopen, because the court clearly did reopen it, can you reopen it for a limited purpose, or once it's reopened, is everything reopened?
I think that the use of the term reopen in this case, as the motion court said, is sort of a misnomer. The motion court's judgment and its finding was that the term reopen was a misnomer in this case, and that the parties had not agreed to reopen in the legal sense that that word is sometimes used. When you grant a motion to reopen, ordinarily what has happened is a motion to reopen has been filed alleging abandonment. A hearing is then held where the court makes a determination of whether there's been abandonment, and then the court rules on the motion and reopens to determine abandonment. Now, the motion court always has jurisdiction to consider a motion to reopen. This court established that in the Crenshaw case. The court can always take up a motion to reopen, and it has jurisdiction to consider that. And here, I think what appears to have happened based on the record and what the motion court apparently credited was that the parties had agreed to reopen, for some purpose, part of this case. And the prosecutors stated later, after filing the motion to dismiss, look, our agreement was to take the case up so the court can make a determination on abandonment. Now, Mr. Gibson said that his recollection was that the prosecutor had agreed to that there was abandonment in the case. The motion court took a look at that, looked at the record, and said, well, what we have here is an agreement to reopen the case. We don't have any stipulation or agreement on the issue of abandonment. And so that has not been settled.
Was it an agreement to allow successive 2915?
It was not expressed in that regard. It was an agreement to reopen.
But in effect, was it a successive 2915?
Well, that's what the motion court concluded was that
if there was abandonment, it's not successive because then we consider you never had a proper 2915. So it begs the question. It's circular. If it's abandoned, it's not successive. If there's not abandonment, it is successive.
Right. And if the motion court had thought there had been abandonment,
Is that a correct statement?
I think that's correct, that if there has been abandonment, it wouldn't be successive because you would be reopening
the original
proceeding.
Let me ask it this way. Obviously, the record in this case is what the record is. But if somebody makes allegations that would constitute abandonment under our case decisions, then the trial court, regardless of whether there was any agreement, would have to have an evidentiary hearing, at least to determine whether there was abandonment, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So what the parties agreed to in other cases, I mean, if abandonment is alleged, the trial court at least has to have a hearing to determine whether or not the facts as alleged were true.
That's correct.
And a trial court could deny a petition to reopen or abandonment if the allegations didn't constitute it, or the court could have a hearing and then determine whether you prove the allegations. Correct.
Unless they're stipulated.
Well, and that raises the question, and I was just going to say that in response to Judge Fisher's question, is that, you know, the parties if there were a stipulation saying, yes, in fact, there was abandonment. Suppose the parties said that, and they said there was abandonment because counsel left out this particular claim. Well, under all prior precedent, leaving a claim out of an amended motion does not legally constitute abandonment. And so that would raise the question of whether the parties can stipulate to something being abandonment that isn't legally recognized as abandonment. And in this case, I guess that raises the question of can the parties agree to allow the trial court to forego the limitations imposed upon it by the rules?
Well, your opponent argues that that once you get past the issue of whether the original motion was timely filed, which is what determines the court's authority, then the procedural requirements can be waived. How do you respond to that?
The court's authority is bounded at the front end and at the back end. At the front end, there has to be a timely petition. But it's also bounded to the back end, and that's what we're dealing with whenever abandonment comes up, because this case was final.
We have nothing saying you can't have successive petitions. I mean, we don't allow it, even though nothing says there's a waiver and you can't have successive. We simply, unless it's abandonment and you reopen it, you don't get to file a second.
Well, there is an express provision.
You have to file it in a certain timely manner. When it's filed here, there's nothing that addresses reopening or not reopening. I guess I didn't state that very clearly.
Well, and forgive me if I go down the wrong path here. No. But there is a provision that says you can't file a successive post-conviction motion. There's also a provision that says, or there's also a rule 7501, that says once the judgment is final, or excuse me, when a judgment comes down in a civil case, the trial court only has 30 days in which to exercise control of that judgment.
But we do permit reopening where you're abandoned under Crenshaw.
Right. There's a judicially recognized exception to the ordinary limits of Rule 7501. And so then the question is, when we talk about the judicially recognized exception to...
It's kind of like recalling the mandate on appeal.
Sure.
Very similar.
Sure, there are exceptions. The court can reacquire jurisdiction in a case to take some action, but we don't have any procedural rules in place that say under Rule 7501, if someone files a motion alleging abandonment, you have to file a responsive pleading or anything of that nature.
What did, I know there's some disagreement. What is the state's position, not what it meant, but what did happen here? What does the record show here about what the agreement was? Did the trial court issue an order reopening?
The trial court issued an order that said that I believe, and I may have to paraphrase it just a little bit, by agreement of the parties, the case is reopened. And that's all it says.
And the defense's position is once you've gotten to reopening, you're kind of past the point of looking at it and deciding whether you should reopen. And the state is saying, we didn't mean we're reaching the merits. We meant we wanted a hearing on whether to reopen. But it doesn't sound like the order said that.
Right. The order didn't say that one way or the other what the case was being reopened to consider. And the prosecutor came back later after filing a motion to dismiss and citing case law saying, we don't think that he's alleged abandonment, and what we've agreed to reopen for was a hearing on whether there was abandonment.
But if I understand you correctly, and I'm not saying I'm an expert on how this works, is that you don't reopen until you've had that preliminary determination. But here the court, the first thing it did was reopen.
Right.
Does
ordinarily,
that change how we look at it?
Ordinarily, in a technical sense, an order to reopen should only be entered after there's been a finding of abandonment or I think if the parties were to stipulate correctly that there had been abandonment.
Let me ask the question this way, Mr. Byron. I mean, don't we want trial courts to err on the side of having evidentiary hearings if the allegations would constitute abandonment?
I would think ordinarily yes.
How about this? Is abandonment a fact question, a legal question, or a mixed question of law and fact?
It involves both, Your Honor, because the historical facts of what occurred are important. But then whether they legally constitute abandonment is a question of law. And the courts have been pretty clear about what legally constitutes abandonment and what does not. So there are historical facts that are important to resolve before a determination of abandonment can be made. Now, ordinarily, yes, we want trial courts to err in favor of holding evidentiary hearing. Here, the court did. The court said, well, let's just hear it all. We'll take up the evidence, the witnesses on the merits of your claim, but you can also present any evidence on abandonment. Now, at the first day of the hearing, Ms. Eastburn and her counsel indicated, well, we're not prepared on the abandonment issue right now, but we'll go ahead on the merits. But 4.5 months later, they had another hearing date where it was continued, and anybody who wanted to present evidence on the abandonment issue could have. Now, the state presented evidence on the abandonment issue on the first day of the hearing by saying, Your Honor, we'd like you to take judicial notice of what happened in the post-conviction case. There was an amended motion filed. It was litigated. There wasn't abandonment. And the prosecutor argued that factually, based on what occurred in the case, there had not been abandonment. Legally, the defendant
had not been abandoned. What if the trial court had accepted, had found there was abandonment here, or had found that you all had stipulated there was abandonment by agreeing to reopen, and had disagreed with the prosecutor that was an open question for it to consider?
Then I suspect we would have filed a cross appeal, or at least argued on appeal that the motion court shouldn't have done that because, absent abandonment, the court didn't have authority to reopen 13 years after the fact.
And so stipulation wouldn't be binding? Is there any case law to say that you can't stipulate in that situation?
Yeah, I would think that in this particular area there isn't any case law. But I would go back to the general notion that in these post-conviction cases where finality is an important consideration, it's an important interest, and where the trial court's authority is bounded by the rules of the court, the proponent of an exception or the person who's asking the court to act within a judicial exception to the rules laid down by this court ought to have to allege and prove all of the facts necessary to take advantage of that exception.
If I disagree with your assessment of that trial court order and agree with Mr. Gibson's assessment, that is that there was no reason that there had to be an adjudication of abandonment because I would read that it was not just agreeing that there could be reopened for that, it was agreeing it could be reopened. Nevertheless, is the trial court's order that found that stipulation and opened it, is that an interlocutory order? So that even if I think what the trial court originally did is different from where the trial court ended up, that the trial court had the ability to modify its order because it was interlocutory?
I would agree, Your Honor. I think that all of those discussions that occurred before the actual hearing could be analogized to pretrial discussions, rulings, those sorts of things. And the trial court makes a ruling up front and says, well, kind of looks like there could be abandonment in this case. Let's go ahead and reopen and have a hearing. If it comes out later that, in fact, there was not abandonment, I don't think the trial court is bound to say, is bound by its previous order. I think it can very easily say, under the rules, there just hasn't, I don't have authority in this case. I can't hear this as successive. I can't reopen because of abandonment. I don't think the court would be bound to do that by that previous ruling. And it raises the question in this case whether the parties, when there are rules in place that operate as boundaries and that tell the court, this is how you should proceed.
Well, 1 second. Judge Wilson, did you have a question? Or
no. Thank you, Chief. No.
This is how the parties should proceed. Can the parties walk into court one day and say, well, Your Honor, we have agreed to proceed in a different manner. The prosecutor has agreed, so let's go ahead and do that, and the court
can... Well, parties do reach stipulations all the time on issues that otherwise would have to be proved, and the court doesn't look behind them normally.
Well, in most cases, though, they do that in the context of... well, first of all, they're made matters of record. If they're going to stipulate to particular facts, they stipulate to those facts, and that wasn't done here. And it's ordinarily done in the context of litigation that is properly before the court. But if parties were to walk in, for example, walk into a court where let me be ridiculous for a moment, where a particular kind of pleading had been filed, that should have been filed in, well, I can't think of a good example. I'm sorry, Your Honor, but if the parties were to walk in and say, well, we've agreed that we would like this person to receive X. So if the court could just order that, we'd appreciate that. Well, I don't think they can do that. There needs to be a live proceeding. There needs to be a live action. And that's the question here. Was there a live action? And did the action come back to life 13 years after the case had already been filed?
I think we know that Mr. Gibson on a rebuttal is going to address retroactivity. Can you briefly address that? And in particular, if he can clearly raise this issue in habeas, if he can't raise it here, what's the point of not just raising it here, and if he did, is it retroactive?
Well, I guess there are a couple of parts to answering that question, and I realize I only have 45 seconds.
Please go ahead and answer.
But with regard to whether this, certainly I think that a state habeas petition, for example, would be an appropriate place to raise this, whereupon the defendant can make the proper allegations and showings to show cause and prejudice or whatever standards come into play with this particular claim. Now, should it simply be construed as a habeas petition here? I suppose the court has that authority. No, I don't suppose. The court does have the authority to construe pleadings that are filed in this court as a habeas petition. Of course, what we have here is merely a notice of appeal. We don't have a habeas petition filed with this court. We have a notice of appeal which challenges a judgment which was limited to one single issue. Now, ordinarily, when somebody wants to file a habeas petition, if they follow Rule 91, and again, I go back to the rules, they would file the petition here, or they wouldn't file it here in the first instance, because unless they show good cause, they should file it in the jurisdiction where the defendant is incarcerated. Here, that didn't happen. It was filed in the sentencing court. Now, if the court were to go ahead and say, well, let's be generous, let's construe this notice of appeal as a habeas petition, incorporate pleadings that came up from below, then I guess the question is, would you incorporate the record from below, any factual findings that the motion court found, or would it be appropriate to appoint a special master? I don't know. But getting to the ultimate question of retroactivity, and I apologize, Your Honor, for digressing, but I think that there are important procedural issues here at play and rules, and I don't think it's that difficult for a defendant to simply follow the rules and file a habeas petition. But getting to retroactivity, there are several courts that have looked at retroactivity specifically and have found that it is not retroactive. And it's the state's position that Miller versus Alabama is not a decision that should be applied retroactively. First of all, because rather than announcing a substantive rule, the court announced a procedural rule. And it's not substantive because the court did not eliminate a class of individuals who are eligible to receive this sentence. The court did not say that these people are, that the state cannot prescribe this, that the state cannot impose this. It merely said that there is a process that must be followed before this sentence can be imposed on certain individuals. The question then should it be retroactive as a procedural rule? Under the Teague standard, which this court did not apply, for example, in the Winfield case, you would have to have something that a procedural rule that was a watershed rule. Now, the Fifth Circuit looked at that recently under the Teague standard and said this is not a watershed rule. This is merely an outgrowth of the court's rulings talking about individualized sentences for people who are convicted of crimes. But under the Linkletter-Stovall rule, which this court applied in the Whitfield case, the analysis is slightly different. And the court looks at three things. First, the purpose served by the rule. Second, the extent of reliance by law enforcement upon the rule. And third, the effect of the administration of justice of retroactive application of the new rule. And I think that under the Linkletter-Stovall case, all three of those weigh against retroactivity. And when you look at the purpose of the rule, the
how
purpose
can law enforcement rely on what happens later in a trial? I don't think they arrest someone differently.
Well, and I guess maybe I read law enforcement
really
a little bit.
That's really addressing Fourth Amendment issues, things like that.
Well, and I suppose it could. And I guess in the broader sense, though, law enforcement would encompass prosecutors as well, and those who prosecute and try cases. And you know, the criminal justice system. Now, I may be wrong in terms of how broadly the term law enforcement has been applied there. And police officers, I would think, do not rely on the old rule. But there's been a lot of reliance in the criminal justice system upon the old rule, and there have been a number of people. And I guess this would go more to the third,
sure.
the third standard instead of law enforcement generally. But the third, and so perhaps the second one doesn't weigh heavily one way or the other. But the third one certainly weighs. Let me qualify that just briefly, Your Honor. It may depend on the remedy that this court announces in terms of whether the third factor is going to weigh heavily in favor of retroactivity or not. I mean, if the court were to conclude, for example, that, hey, we could just fix all 80-some-odd cases by just striking a couple of words off of the judgment, I don't suppose that imposes creates a huge burden on the administration of justice because we're going to change a few things. Although, perhaps I'm being too glib there and not thinking far enough ahead, because the administration of justice is not merely correcting the judgments that will come, but the effect that will flow from that when all of these cases then have to be set for parole hearings and those sorts of things, which is going to require a lot of consideration and maybe even require people who long felt thought that this case had come to rest to then stand up and say, wait a minute, and attend parole hearings and those sorts of things. Victims have a right to be apprised of those things. So I apologize. I have to retract my statement a little bit by saying that the remedy may decrease the effect on the criminal justice system a little bit, but it's not going to be easy no matter what the remedy is, because if all of these defendants become eligible for parole suddenly due to the remedy that comes into play, there will be an adverse impact on the criminal justice system in that as all these cases come up for hearings, that, you know, these old cases need to be reexamined.
And how do we balance those kind of issues against, I mean, if you're going to be counting costs, then, you know, certainly if people do get out on parole, that frees up space in the prisons, and presumably if the parole boards find that's appropriate, that felt justice so required, which by definition would be a benefit.
It may free up space in the prisons, and as an administrative matter for Department of Corrections, that may be important, but I don't think that matters in the retroactivity analysis.
What other factors would go into that consideration? And I appreciate the one you mentioned. Are there other factors that this court should look at in looking at the Stovall analysis?
When I think the Linkletter-Stovall analysis, I think it would come down basically to the second one, perhaps not being not weighing heavily one way or the other, but the first one weighing in favor of not being retroactive, because the purpose here is not to effectuate vast change in the system. It really is to make sure that going forward, that when we impose these sentences, we allow a senator an opportunity to consider certain things.
And I have taken you way past, so I apologize.
Yes, and I apologize, Your Honor.
Answering my question, I appreciate it.
I simply wanted to be thorough, and I misspoke a little bit and wanted to clear that up, but I think the third one weighs pretty heavily against retroactivity.
Thank you.
No apology. I mean, stay there. There might be more questions. But no apology. You extended the last question rule very, very well.
Thank you, Your Honor.
But any more questions from the court here? Thank you very much. Now, you'll have more time. Don't worry about it.
I would hope
we
so.
We have the retroactivist. Don't worry about it.
Retroactively give you more time.
Judge Wilson would testify that he had 15 minutes. We kept him here 20 minutes longer than his 15 minutes.
Right. I understand. I don't think it's a close question that it's Miller is retroactive. In the Jackson versus Hobbs case, the state of Arkansas conceded that point last week. Under the Linkletter test, the only types of rules that have been held not to be retroactive are things that either have a significant impact on police investigation tactics, like Miranda, the exclusionary rule, the lineup procedure, that was Stovall itself. Batson is not retroactive. Basically, it's a substantive versus procedural type of argument under the first part of it. And even under the more onerous Teague test, issues that affect the fairness and accuracy of the proceeding are almost always held to be retroactive. That's why Miranda isn't, but the rule on coerced confessions is. And I don't think it's a close question that the first two points are weigh heavily in favor under the Stovall test of retroactivity. The only other issue that he relied on is the effect on the process. And quite frankly, I don't think, as I mentioned in my opening argument, I don't think there's going to be contested resentencings in very many of these cases.
Well, I mean, that's an issue. What if we had to have new trials in 84 cases?
The Illinois case that I cited, Williams, held that under the similar test that they have 105, that would not overly burden their system.
Well, presumably the prosecution and defense would look at the Miller factors, and some would.
Particularly if you look at the language from Miller, where they say that a life sentence should be rare. And I think if you look at particularly Miss Eastburn's case, this prosecutor originally agreed to offer her 30 years before he caved into pressure from the victim's family and backed out. And I think there's a really good chance. Miss Eastburn's been in prison more than 20 years. I think if a jury particularly heard the evidence that's raised under the ineffectiveness claim under point three that I haven't had time to mention, that I think there's a real good possibility they'd give her less 20 years or less, given her exemplary record
what
in
about
prison.
I want you to have an opportunity to deal with the issue that this is not a categorical bar. It's just they left life without parole in place, and the manner in which you can do it now is just affected. The procedure's affected. Normally, those types of cases are not retroactive. They go forward.
I think the Illinois cases that I cited in the reply brief sort of deal with that. It is procedural in the sense the one strand, the Lockett-Eddings strand of it, is procedural. However, the mandatory proportionality part of it is substantive. So it's got a substantive and a procedural component. But I don't think you can seriously argue that this Constitution, Eighth Amendment claim has more of an impact on the fairness and accuracy of a sentencing proceeding than Ring versus Arizona that this court held retroactive in the Whitfield case. I don't think it's a close call.
Those Illinois cases, I think those were intermediate courts of appeal. Do you know whether or not those have been transferred to their Supreme Court?
I do not know. I think the great majority of authority has found it retroactive, not mainly
there
because
there hadn't been much authority either way, has there? If there is, supplementing
not a lot,
to the court would be very helpful.
I mean, it's interesting. I think they conceded it in Jackson, but I think really what it should end the inquiry is the fact that Jackson itself was a habeas case. And if it wasn't retroactive, Jackson would have lost.
Well, the argument is that that was waived by the state in that case. Can you
on purpose.
But I don't know. They didn't mention that in their opinion, but I think in light of what happened, it was waived in front of the Arkansas Supreme
yes.
Court after remand. Yeah, they didn't concede it because I think if you look at Teague versus Lane and Yates versus Evitt, all the cases, I forget the one that the other case, if it's retroactive in that case and you've got a similar claim, then it's retroactive to everybody.
It seems, to my knowledge and from what I've seen in filing, there's just two or three cases on each side, and there doesn't seem to have, I presume there's a lot of litigation yet going on that hasn't resulted.
Well, the only cases that have found it not to be retroactive applied Teague versus Lane, which, if
right.
you, as you well know, they held under Teague, the U.S. Supreme Court, that Ring isn't retroactive. However, this court held
it was. And,
of
course, Teague applies everywhere, state and federal court. The question, I mean, you have to apply Stovall in a way that at least meets the minimum set by Teague.
Under Minnesota versus Danforth, this court's free to apply their own retroactive rule.
Because Teague is an issue of federalism.
That's federal habeas rule. It's a judge-created rule in federal habeas actions. There's nothing that requires state courts to follow it.
Well, tell me about the cases that don't follow Teague and that do apply it retroactively. What's their rationale? And
you're talking about the Illinois cases?
Are there other cases in addition?
There is a Louisiana case. I think it's called Williams. There's a Louisiana case that found it retroactive. There's a federal district case in Michigan, which is the same jurisdiction where a state court held it wasn't, a federal judge did.
If those are not cited in your brief, could you send a letter to the court with their citations and opposing counsel?
Just in my remaining run over time, since Mr. McElprain got about an extra 7 minutes, I'd like
equal time.
He's got three more minutes under that rule.
I would like to briefly talk about the remedy again and the procedural issue. Like I mentioned before, in the mandatory, this is just like the mandatory death penalty cases, and since there is no savings clause, this is an unconstitutional as applied case, just like the cases that this court addressed with the sex offender things, notification and being near a school. There's nothing unconstitutional per se about the statute, but it's unconstitutional as applied to juveniles. There's no doubt about that. And in that situation, the law is clear. 1.140 does not apply, as Judge Wilson pointed out, and that the Molesby case, the Bergen case, says that the conviction has to be set aside. And so the proper remedy, as was done in a lot of the mandatory death penalty litigation in the 70s, under Harper, under Duren, would be to resentence Miss Eastburn in front of a judge, or in her case, a jury, since she hasn't waived it, to second-degree murder, which is conceded. In fact, in that case, the court or the defense submitted second-degree murder, both as felony and conventional, and argued that's what she was guilty of.
So you're not
of.
Saying under that scenario were this court to agree with you that there would need to be a jury trial because second-degree murder would have been proved in it, or you're saying a
no,
jury
No, I think she is entitled under 557.036 to a jury sentencing if she elects to do so. She could obviously waive that.
10 to 30 years or life?
I can't imagine that we would, but given her the facts of her case. But I think that's the procedure. And whatever happens, there's not going to be any more appeals. You're not going to have to deal with proportionality as set forth about the rarity of deaths or of these, where it should be rare that life without parole could ever be sustained. Which is the last point, which I never got a chance to mention, is Miss Eastburn raised a categorical bar to accomplices being convicted and given life without parole. And I think this is a perfect case to address that. Cuntrell Jackson raised it in the Arkansas Supreme Court, and they sort of sidestepped the issue because he's entitled to a resentencing where he can get a minimum of 10 years up to a life without parole sentence, from my understanding of Arkansas law.
By your count, how many judges on the U.S. Supreme Court would apply a categorical bar to that age limit? Is it
two?
That's 7-2.
That's true. But they sidestepped the issue that this court addressed in Andrews too. But I don't want to fight that battle again today. My point being is that this, you might decide to do what the Arkansas Supreme Court did, particularly since it might moot the point out, because I don't believe there's any chance that she would get life without parole on resentencing. But the point being, this is an ideal case to address it if you want to, because the jury instructions for first-degree murder, which I've had a problem with that for my whole career, that although it technically complies with the MAI, there's no requirement that they find that she killed or intended to kill, only that she aided and encouraged the other two in promoting the death. And if you look at the jury instructions, it's clear that she was not, nobody ever alleged she was the trigger person in this. The other two boys were the ones who shot her ex-husband. Finally, it gives me a little bit of pleasure to accuse the state of being an obstructionist in this case. Miss Eastburn's been in prison over 20 years. It's in her interest and every other litigant's interest to have the issue of retroactivity and remedy resolved as expeditiously as possible. And you would have to ignore a century worth of law on judicial estoppel, the enforcement of stipulations, and waiver to find that what happened on March 1st of 2011 in front of the circuit court was not a stipulation to reopen the case. The order says by agreement of the parties, the motion to reopen is granted, the case will be returned to an active docket for disposition. That means the underlying claims will be addressed on their merits. There's no other way to interpret it. It's a binding stipulation. It is because they caved in and changed their mind about disposing of the case 6 months later. If this was an ordinary civil litigant, it would be clear what would happen. It would be a situation in a post-conviction case, for instance, the state, even if there was a more explicit concession that the case ought to be reopened, and then the judge granted relief on the merits, and then they raised on appeal, oh, you shouldn't have reopened it in the first place.
But here we have the issue, it's like if someone denies there was a settlement, we have an issue where the state disagrees as to what it agreed to, and the trial. So we don't, because it wasn't in writing here, it presents
the order was in writing.
Yes, the order absolutely reopening was in writing.
Well, with all due respect to Mr. McElprang, he wasn't there and I was. And I know what happened. It's ironic that the court is always carving out exceptions for criminal defendants where they don't get to play by the same procedural rules or have to overcome greater rules than other civil litigants. It ought to be the other way around. Justice delayed is justice denied. And this court, when someone stipulates to something to move a case along, which is what happened, they can't change their mind 6 months later like the prosecutor did in this case.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I just want to thank the litigants on both cases for doing an excellent job. I want to thank the audience, the litigants, for your patience. I just want to say that we're trying with a prodigious energy, and we ask a lot of questions to find the correct solution.